You're listening to Food Confidence, a podcast about approachable health and imperfect food, all for the sake of the next generation. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul. We are two non-diet health professionals on a mission to empower parents and caregivers in raising food and body confident kids.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of the Food Confidence Podcast. Today, we're chatting with Dr. Karina Dunlap and Greta Jarvis. Dr. Karina Dunlap is a licensed naturopathic doctor and medical researcher specializing in women's health at all stages of life. She earned her doctorate in naturopathic medicine and master of science in integrative medicine research from the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Dunlap's work is frequently published in medical journals. She's a clinician and medical consultant, often asked to write for and speak to medically trained audiences.
Greta Jarvis is the founder of Nutrition for Good, where she helps women discover authentic health, peace, and freedom amidst the diet and weight-crazed world. She recently graduated with her Master's of Science in Nutrition from the National University of Natural Medicine, and she also has a certification as an integrative health coach and as a certified intuitive eating counselor.
We're so excited to bring this episode to you guys today. As somebody who just had my second child, and obviously, you know, periods and ovulation are the center of your universe when you're trying to conceive, when you're pregnant, and even in your fourth trimester, your postnatal experience. But above and beyond that, this conversation is so important because we're trying to break down some of the taboos around periods and ovulation and hormone health. And that applies to anybody, regardless of, you know, if you are, you know, a female who ovulates and has a period, if you are in a menopausal state, there's information for you. If you are trying to conceive, if you are a parent, if you're a male and you have a woman in your life, I mean, literally there is nobody that this subject should disclude. So we're really excited to bring this to you and to hopefully break down that taboo and get more acquainted with periods.
Absolutely. And of course, you said it well, that this conversation really applies to everybody. Of course, the podcast is generally geared towards parents and caregivers, but again, this episode mm-hmm. can apply to anybody.
Yeah.
And then the other great thing that I loved about this episode was really how it expanded on the topics we've been talking about all season, which are intuitive eating and health at every size and body diversity and body trust. So we will get right into our conversation with Dr. Dunlap and Greta. We think it's going to be a mind-blowing episode for everybody.
Yeah, there's so much good information here. We're really excited to present it to you. So turn it up and get comfortable. Dr. Dunlap and Greta, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us. So excited.
Yeah, we're so excited.
So if you wouldn't mind, just start off by telling our audience who you are and what you do.
Okay, great. I'll get started. So my name is Dr. Karina Dunlap, and I am a licensed naturopathic physician and researcher with a focus in women's health. And I'm very passionate about helping women with every aspect of their health and all phases of life. And I got my doctorate in naturopathic medicine, and I'll explain more about that later, but as well as my master's in integrative medical research, which is unto itself a whole nother field of study that most doctors actually don't get. So it's unique in my training to have both of those together, but I'm very passionate about how to bring the kind of like the bench, we call it bench to bedside. So how to bring research to the general population and how to apply it in practice. And what I do a lot of speaking and training of other doctors, as well as mentoring students in research. So when students have a desire to study a specific topic, especially around women's health, I will often work with them to help bring that research desire, passion into a real life kind of scenario or setting and bring it to life. So that brings us to how Greta and I met. So Greta, I'll let you take it from here.
Awesome. Thank you. My name's Greta Jarvis, and I just finished my Master's of Science in Nutrition at the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon, which, as Dr. Dunlap mentioned, is how we became connected. and we'll dive into our research a little bit later. I'm also a certified intuitive eating counselor and have my certification as an integrative health coach. So I am the founder of a business. It's called Nutrition for Good, and I work with women to navigate their intuitive eating journey and build body confidence in this diet and weight crazed world.
That's amazing. We love that. And we're so excited to have you guys here and to hear a little bit more about your work together. But before we kind of dive into that, how did you guys get into this line of work?
Yeah. So I, like I said, incredibly passionate about women's health. I mean, it's really just been part of women's empowerment has been part of my life kind of journey. I think I've always been called to it from the time I was probably recognized it when I was in high school and I wanted to kind of write for underground journals about women's health topics. And I didn't really know why, but I was just really like really into it from topics such as female circumcision to all sorts of kind of controversial topics I'd kind of pick up and write about or learn about. And then went to an all women's college. I went to Smith College. I was just wanted to be around really smart and passionate women who wanted to make a difference in the world. And then when I went after school, I worked for Hour Bound and I had guided women's rock climbing and mountaineering courses that were specific to women. And I was really just, I thought it was so cool that, you know, what men can do, women can do too. And it's just like, we can do anything, you know, just finding that kind of empowerment through movement and just challenging ourselves in different ways. And then found my way to naturopathic medicine. So basically, my journey into naturopathic medicine was born from myself actually getting really sick. I went to India for some work with the World Health Organization, and I was there for about 6 months, and I got really, really sick, as many people do when they travel, you know, kind of your general like traveler's diarrhea that just, for me, it really progressed. And when I came home, it was really through my work with a naturopathic doctor and an Ayurvedic doctor through about after many, many failed rounds of antibiotics, I realized the conventional approach wasn't working for me. So I worked with a naturopathic doctor and an Ayurvedic doctor to help me rebuild my health. And it taught me so much. And I realized that this was going to be my next step in what I wanted to do. So that was where I kind of started my path in naturopathic medicine. And in women's health, that really just kind of fit well for me as a kind of what I love and want to do in life, just empowering women again. And in terms of this kind of area and how everything starts to cross over, women's bodies are incredibly, what I find is women's bodies are incredibly sensitive to starvation cues. And I see a lot of things come, a lot of women come in, and we're going to talk about what functional hypothalamic amenorrhea is in a moment, but I see many women come in and they've decided to put themselves on a highly restrictive diet. You know, they might start feeling better for some reasons, but then what ends up happening is get really out of balance. And, you know, it might be something from like intermittent fasting to keto or something like that. And they come in and they're like, you know, I'm all out of whack. I don't know why. I thought I was doing something right. And we just have to back up and start peeling away what's going on. And, talk about how sensitive hormones are. And I just love, 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 love this work. But yeah. And then Greta, why don't you give a little bit of background about how you got into this?
Yeah, absolutely. So I studied public health in my undergrad degree. And so I grew up being an athlete too. So I've been active and just interested in health and nutrition and wellness. But, you know, as we are all swimming in these diet culture waters, I was thinking maybe going into dietetics or some realm of public health. And I'm from Portland, Oregon, which is where the Naturopathic University is. So I can't remember who, a family friend shared the degree, and it just had a more, you know, holistic is such a buzzword these days, but I really enjoyed the curriculum. They talk about farm to table and psychology of eating. There's a food relationship course. So it just really was just a way for me to explore these areas of health and wellness. And it seemed more, it had more depth than just, you know, cranking out meal plans. And it really aims to get at the root, like Dr. Dunlap was talking about, the root of what does health mean and how does it change for each person. And I don't remember exactly where I discovered intuitive eating, but I just remember reading it for the first time and having just everything click into place and realizing, oh, wow, there's a framework for this. This is working. What a beautiful way to help people reconnect with their bodies and pursue health in a way that really is holistic, because I think a lot of times in the holistic health world, it doesn't feel truly holistic when we're not paying attention to body image and food relationships, and it's a much broader conversation. So that is what brought me to where I am today.
One of the things that we kind of see too, just to kind of speak off of what you just said, is, you know, we see the extremes, and we have, you know, Andrea is a registered dietitian, I am, you know, a certified health coach, and so we've existed on opposite ends of the spectrum, but kind of that middle ground that is missing from both common practices is that intuitive eating and HACE lens.
Absolutely. I'm just really loving the variety of different expertise areas. And I also love hearing both of your stories of how you found your passion and your career path, and how that really is just kind of lined up with things that you already held as values. I think that's so cool.
Like helping is
right. And Greta, I mean, certainly I wish in my dietetics training that I had, you know, food relationship classes and stuff like that. It was a lot of, you know, it's Western conventional medical numbers and such like that. I mean, there were some great courses as well. And I had some great professors, not to, you know, undermine that, but I think those body image and eating disorder and, again, food relationship courses would have been so valuable. Yeah. I feel like I would have gotten to this place a little bit sooner. But anyway,
absolutely.
I'd love to hear from one or both of you, what exactly is a naturopathic doctor or naturopathic medicine, and what distinguishes this type of care from a more Western approach?
Yeah, sure. So there was a, you know, I want to kind of launch into this topic about what naturopathic medicine is by, first of all, clarifying that, you know, naturopathic doctors are not simply what we call, we have a term for it, it's called green allopathy or green allopathist. So we're not simply practicing physicians swapping out prescriptions for supplements, but that is a perception. And I think that there are many different degrees of how naturopathic medicine is practiced. Some may just simply prescribe supplements, but really our training is very complex and multifactorial. So we go through, licensed naturopathic doctors go through 4 years of training, just like MDs. We get 2 years of basic science training, everything in terms of biochemistry, anatomy, phys, everything. We take by basic medical boards, just like MDs do. We study from the same texts for all of that. In our last 2 years of training, we go through our more clinical pieces. So we're getting pharmaceutical training, but we're also getting training in the extensive realm of botanical medicine. We get 2 years of nutrition. Most MDs get zero nutrition, honestly. I mean, it's starting to change now, but very, very little.
I heard Western MDs get about 8 hours of
nutrition. Yeah, it's really. We get trained in, you know, imaging, diagnostics, lab diagnostics, all of your basic pathology and physiology that MDs do as well. But on top of that, we do. We get the nutrition, botanicals. We have certain therapies. One is known as hydrotherapy that we learn about. That's using water-based therapy to help heal and calm the body. We get trained in high-dose vitamin therapy for people that have deficiencies or may be suffering from GI conditions. We train in IV care, intramuscular care. You know, it goes on, the list goes on and on, but we have very extensive work in both the physical body, emotional body, and also some spiritual work too. So it's really very extensive. I didn't realize, honestly, what I was getting myself into until I started the school program. And about 50% of my class, there was that high of a nutrition rate, because it was so demanding and kind of, ironic because you're studying something that's very supposed to be really helpful and healing, but you're kind of putting yourself through the kind of hell in a way to get there. So when we come out of school, we're really wanting to look at people from the most holistic standpoint we can, and our guiding principles really are use the most effective treatment with the least invasiveness, trust in the healing power of nature, and really use a lot of education and empowerment with what we're doing, and very multimodal. So we're not only talking about, we're doing lifestyle medicine, we're talking about rhythms in health, you know, how we're living. The how is as important as the what. And certainly supplements do come into that picture, of course, because we can deliver very quality, high-dose nutrients in or botanicals that way, but we can also do it via, you know, other methods too. So it doesn't have to just be that. But I think there is this perception that we're supplement doctors, but really there's so much more. Oh my gosh, so much more that we can do.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think too, kind of what we were touching on earlier about being on two opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of like holistic health and then a more Western approach. Yeah. I do think that, you know, intuitive eating and health at every size, that's building the bridge to connect these two types of medicine. And in a way that's really just patient focused. Yes. and trying to help people however that needs to look, you know, because every single patient, every single person is different, and you cannot apply a blanket approach to all. And to be able to have that lens to look a little bit deeper, I think is really great. And that's that bridge that I think we're building.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Everyone has different relationship with food and how they've been influenced. You know, there's a similar theme in our culture, which is a lot of what you guys talk about. And I so appreciate, oh my gosh, the message that you're helping to spread is incredible. We're all, you know, working with that too now, more and more, I think. But yeah, an individualized approach is incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm really curious to hear about today, which I don't know a lot about other than the fact that I am a woman with a period, is FHA. Can you tell our audience more about what that is? And maybe, I know you've kind of already said why women's health is so interesting to you, but kind of why this is so important.
Sure. I'm going to jump into kind of the medical background of it. And then Greta's going to start talking about it too, because she's been really, really analyzing the research and looking at it from a research perspective. So I want her to talk about that. But FHA, or functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, is basically when there's either a decreased caloric intake or an excessive energy expenditure, or both, and or stress that disrupt the communication between the hypothalamus, which is in our brain, to the reproductive organs, so that women stop bleeding or stop having their menses. And the symptom typically is either they stop having their menses or they come off of some form of birth control and they're not getting their periods back. Now, there can be many reasons why women aren't getting their periods after coming off of birth control, but FHA is one that is very common and often very much, in my opinion, mismanaged and underdiagnosed, or kind of brushed aside as not, or kind of commonplace and not important to really treat the underlying cause. So I'll let Greta kind of jump in from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one really important point to make just right out of the gate is that FHA impacts women of all body sizes and all. I think a lot of times we think, you know, oh, it's the Olympic athlete or this elite conditioned athlete who deals with this, but it's really more common than I think a lot of people realize, right? Because it's not something that you can see by looking at a person. And so that's where we think this conversation is so important, because among physicians and coaches and athletes and just women experiencing this condition themselves, there is not a lot of resources and support. So that's something that I always like to bring to light, is this impacts a lot of people. And also it's just interesting looking at kind of what is expected around being a female in our culture. When we look at this kind of normalization of body shame and dieting, and a lot of that plays into potentially developing FHA. So it's challenging when those behaviors like restricting food or cutting out certain food groups are not only prescribed, but praised and celebrated in our culture. And then it could, you know, when taken too far, result in FHA, which has a lot of consequences that aren't really talked about in the doctor's office or in the gym, you know, and among women themselves, because menstruation is seen as kind of this messy inconvenience rather than this really powerful biological function that just is, it's important to pay attention to and can tell us a lot.
Yeah. And some of the long-term consequences, I'll just jump in there. So if reproductive age women are not cycling off of birth control, it can lead to long-standing estrogen deficiency that puts them at risk for low bone mineral density. So that can look like osteopenia or osteoporosis, easy breaks, and impact their mobility long-term. It also can lead to sexual dysfunction issues such as vaginal pain and dryness. Also mood disorders, things like anxiety and depression. And those things rear their heads very frequently when women aren't ovulating and aren't cycling. Mm.
And would you say that it's fair to say then that like a risk of diet culture and participating in diet culture, even if you might not think that you're restricting all that much, but just having some sort of deficit in calories, you know, that can play a role. So would you say that that's diet culture in and of itself can be a risk to developing FHA?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I think, so we don't have a formalized risk assessment tool, but we do know risk factors include body dissatisfaction, a drive for thinness, restrictive diets, perfectionistic tendencies. So all these things that you could also easily explain diet culture with too. So I would say 100% really navigating this issue while living in a culture where that is also prevalent really compounds the severity and the misunderstanding and mismanagement around FHA.
I completely agree. And unless the treatment approach incorporates the relationship with food and how food is consumed or restricted, it's so incredibly difficult to kind of undo this, the effect of this disruption in the communication between the brain and the reproductive glands.
Yeah. Greta, I love what you said about, you know, FHA isn't something that you can see. It happens to people of all body types. That kind of also reminds me of PCOS or polycystic ovarian syndrome. You know, that happens in bodies of all shapes and sizes. And again, it's a female hormonal, right? Female reproductive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. I didn't agree that we would talk about PCOS. Yeah.
Well, I know that one's a common, I mean, that one's the most common hormone condition in women. So, you know, that one and all different. Yeah. So many doctors kind of don't examine that when women don't have their periods, if they're kind of, you know, more like a thin shaped body because they're assuming they're not PCOS kind of candidate, but they are, you know, PCOS comes in all shapes. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And one thing I like to say specifically about FHA is it's about behaviors, not body type, right? So
exactly.
A lot of times if a woman comes in a larger body who may be over-exercising or restricting her food, it's really common that she's kind of brushed aside because there's this idea that women who suffer with FHA are in this, you know, emaciated frame. And that's absolutely not the case at all. Your body doesn't know what your BMI is. And no matter where you fall along that spectrum, it's not having a period is a huge problem. And it's something to address. Why is this happening? What behaviors are disrupting that communication? Like we were talking about between brains and ovaries, it's not, okay, you need to get to XYZ weight or consume XYZ calories, because it's really not that simple. Your body's not a machine.
Mm. Yeah, that's point well taken. I'm wondering if a patient, for example, you know, she's noticing that her period is missing or it's sporadic, what kind of questions should she be asking her doctor when she goes into the doctor's office to kind of address that concern? Mm-hmm. Are there any tests that can be done or?
Yeah, FHA is a little bit more of a diagnosis of exclusion. So first of all, we'll look at hormone panels. When women come in and they're not getting their period, first of all, I want to emphasize that if you're not getting your period and you're not on some form of birth control, don't let any doctor tell you that that's just normal and that's okay. You absolutely want a doctor to examine and dive into why you're not having your period. It is a huge cue from the body that something is off. The body will conserve and it will conserve all metabolic function to protect more of what it considers its vital organs. So, you know, ovaries might not be considered one of the vital organs once there's some kind of cue that the body is needing to protect or conserve. So when periods are not happening, it absolutely needs to be examined and figured out. So we can do hormone testing, and that might include also looking at other hormones, not just like our estrogen and progesterone hormones, but looking at hormones from the brain, including things like prolactin, which is a hormone that can suppress ovulation, suppress menstrual flow. There can be all sorts of reasons why menses stop, from structural, tumor issue to, more what we call functional or just basic hormones. So there can be a lot of reasons. So we dive into basically an algorithm. We can look at thyroid, we look at prolactin, we look at the FSH, LH, estrogen, progesterone. We can look at those pieces to see what's going on, and then make sure the adrenals are functioning properly. And yeah, so there are a lot of tests we do as doctors to see and examine, you know, what is going on. That's there's a kind of what we call an amenorrhea or no menstrual kind of algorithm we follow.
Dr. Dunlap, is that something that is just available through, say, a naturopathic doctor, or is that something that can be ordered through a Western doctor, your regular PCP?
Yeah, the amenorrhea workup or diagnosis is algorithm is available to all doctors. We follow kind of like a standard of care approach. There's a amenorrhea algorithm that is available to all doctors. So it's not just a naturopathic doctor, but when you go into your doctor and you aren't getting your period, you want to say, I'd like an amenorrhea workup, you know, and they should be able to do all the testing necessary, like exactly what I said, to find out and come up with a reason why that's happening.
Thank you.
And also, just to hop in on that point, this is a condition, like we had talked about before, is widely misunderstood. And there are times where someone who is experiencing FHA may receive the diagnosis of quote unquote lean PCOS if they are in a smaller frame. So it's very important that you make sure your medical provider is well-versed in these topics and really is familiar with that diagnostic process, because the treatment modality for PCOS is, you know, standard of care is usually some sort of restricted diet as well as increased exercise. So if you get that PCOS diagnosis and that is the recommendations you are receiving, if you're actually experiencing FHA, that will make the problem worse. So just do your homework, make sure whoever you're visiting can really dive into how do you diagnose PCOS? What's the difference when we're looking at FHA, regardless of what size body the patient is in?
And so on that point, can you dive a little bit into kind of like what the next steps would be if you receive that diagnosis, or maybe even like why conventional birth control or contraceptive kind of hormone management isn't exactly the right next step, or maybe you could elaborate on exactly what that looks like.
Yeah, well, Greta and I would both love to talk about this one. So most doctors will right away prescribe oral birth control or some form of estrogen and progestin combined to treat women who have been diagnosed with FHA. Because that is kind of the standard of care treatment approach. Although actually, when you look in the literature, first line treatment is to discuss what's the patterns of eating, and not only the what, but the how, and also the stress levels and exercise levels. But it is actually an incredibly challenging condition to treat, incredibly challenging. And I honestly think, and the reason why Greta and I wanted to talk to you guys and be on the podcast, honestly, is to bring awareness, because unless we get to the root of why there's restriction occurring, and actually discuss the whole diet culture and how that's influencing restrictive behavior unless we talk about it and start really peeling away those pieces. And this is what I do in my office with my patients too, is really if I have somebody comes in and they get the diagnosis of FHA, there's no way to treat it naturally unless we really start talking about that stuff. So there's no supplement that's going to work on its own. It's really about the patterns of eating and restriction, and also stress. Stress can do it too. So really peeling away those layers is hugely important. But doctors will often give birth control because it is so challenging to treat naturally with the first line therapies, and they want to protect women's health in terms of their long-term health, in terms of their bone health. So estrogen replacement is a bone protecting drug. So it's not just a doctor kind of wanting to palliate or, band-aid it, but often they'll do that because it is protective and they don't want women to become osteoporotic or osteopenic, without their menstrual flow.
Mm-hmm. And I will add on to that. So essentially, like Dr. Dunlap was saying, most women, when they go in to see their doctor, may hear the message either, it's a normal thing. If you're an athlete, this is just to be expected. Or the birth control pill is another common option. So you may get a bleed with the birth control pill. And, if you're taking that pill and, okay, great, I have my period back, this is amazing. But it's important to recognize that a withdrawal bleed from taking the birth control pill is not a natural biological period. Because even though that pill is delivering these synthetic hormones, your brain is still not producing those hormones on its own. So it doesn't address that maybe you're over-exercising or maybe you're not eating enough or maybe you're overstressed. So as soon as you go off the pill, that root cause is still going to be there. And another, I think, just powerful illustration is that a healthy menstrual cycle involves 20 plus hormones. They're all interacting with each other and there's still a lot we don't know about that. And if you're taking a pill, it's usually one or two of those synthetic hormones. So it's really not addressing the whole picture. And I always want to be careful and just talk about it's a woman's right to choose. And I think a lot of times we aren't given the full picture and the full explanation about what is really happening in our bodies. And the pill is just given without that background information so that we are able to make that informed choice about our health.
Exactly. Yeah. Greta and I wanted to be very clear about that message that the pill is a treatment option and it is an option that women, we just feel should need more informed consent around, what are all my options? What do we do? Do we have a plan A and a plan B? What are the side effects? And also the type of hormone that's delivered through birth control pills are very different than the hormones that are produced by the body. So we want to be clear about all of that too. Make sure women feel good about their choices because they feel like they have all the information provided.
Yeah. So you're kind of saying that essentially, birth control is and can be very helpful in a certain way, but it's not exactly going to solve this issue and that it really deserves a closer look.
Exactly. And I have prescribed birth control for this, when it's like, and so that it's important at some point to say, okay, if the period's not back, this is a good, very good option because the long-term ramifications of not, and it might be like, let's do this for a little while, give your body a little bit of a break, kind of undo some of the underlying kind of things that might be there, and then maybe try coming off and give it another go, but allow the body to have some of those hormones present as opposed to having a deficiency in those hormones can be better than ongoing estrogen deficiency, especially.
And I actually was wondering, like, if you're a woman who menstruates and you're missing your period, at what point should you kind of raise a red flag if you miss a period? Is it 1 month? Is it 2 months? Like, kind of what's that time frame that we should be saying, let me pay closer attention?
Right. When it's not related to pregnancy, maybe.
Yeah. Our bodies are incredibly sensitive to stress. Women's bodies are incredibly sensitive to stress. So sometimes a missed period is without pregnancy. That can be very common and what I consider even normal sometimes. I mean, even like, stressful event in the in your life or like a lot of travel can throw off women's periods too often. But if it's an ongoing thing greater than, I would say, 2 months, or if the other scenario is women are noticing irregular periods, like very irregular. And what we define as irregular is anything that's more frequent than 25 days of bleeding or longer than 35 days of bleeding. Those are kind of the diagnostic terms of irregular, but longer or shorter, too short or too long, or something fluctuating in there, or no period at all for, you know, 3 months. You should, after, you know, about 3 months, I would go in. I mean, there's no need to wait, really.
So what about women who, you know, we have this idea of restrictive behaviors, whether it's restricting food or overexercising or stress, but what about women who are suffering from other chronic diseases, especially things like GI diseases, where they're not absorbing, you know, they may not be able to absorb as much nutrition as they need, as many calories as they need. So what are kind of the relationships between those diseases and hormone function? You know, how can we support our health if there's a flare up or something to that effect with other chronic diseases?
And for our audience, we're talking about ulcerative colitis, UC or Crohn's, or maybe even celiac disease.
Yeah, it's such a balancing act, because in those conditions, we can provide a huge therapeutic benefit by treating somebody around stress, you know, decreasing stress, decreasing inflammation. Sometimes decreasing the inflammation does involve removing any like really high food allergens for them, or triggering. And so there's that restrictive piece, right? That you have to walk that line extremely carefully, especially as naturopathic doctors. I think that we can attract more of this orthorexic population. So, you know, there could be a huge therapeutic benefit from finding what those really triggering or high allergen foods are for people. And also talking about, it's not necessarily the food itself, but kind of the tolerance, the body's tolerance around maybe a certain type of food that is challenging. So if you have celiac disease, clearly the gluten, you know, needs to be removed in order for the body to start to heal. But how do we balance that out with not just like restrictive behavior, but incorporating other foods? So if there's anything taken out for you know, if it's a short-term or long-term process, how can we give more back? You know, how can we incorporate not just like a restrictive pattern, but also like here are all these other things that can be incorporated into one's diet. So how do we help balance out hormones? We just have to be clearly making sure that women are not starving. There's a huge, you know, I talk about the starvation and restriction, that it's not just a restriction, that there's really, that the body is feeling like it's well nourished, and that there's still a very intuitive, you know, for lack of a better word, really intuitive way of eating. And that this food is not seen necessarily as the enemy either. It's the body somehow has become sensitive to a food type. But maybe it's about more, and this is what I see, it's about building kind of tolerance. You know, we lose tolerance based on restrictive eating, based on just focusing on, you know, not having a very broad diet. But it's complex, and I tell my patients, you know, I want you to eat expansively. My goal for you long term is to eat extremely expansively and to feel free in what you choose, feel free to eat how you want. So it's a really fine line dance, but yeah, the starvation cues are huge. So that's something I really work on.
And I think too, when we're weaving intuitive eating into this, you know, obviously if you have something like celiac disease, gluten is something that will be triggering to the body. But when we're looking at different allergies or intolerances that people bring in and tell you, to really unpack those and examine that relationship with food, examine, you know, if you're feeling extreme stress and fear around XYZ food, you may experience some digestive discomfort because of that feedback with, you know, your brain and your body are so closely connected. So I never want to minimize anyone's experience of, you know, this food upsets my stomach. And it's important to unpack that a little bit, because oftentimes what we do see is once people are able to trust their bodies more, feel more relaxed around whatever food they have been restricting, those digestive issues do just get better. And so that's something that's really interesting. And I think a point that's not often brought up is that psychosomatic, the $10 word for that body brain connection, is really powerful. So if we're not talking about food relationship, there are just some things that can be missed.
Yeah, Greta, you pretty much took the words right out of my brain. It's themes that are coming up here around, you know, the gut brain connection are so interesting. And I know the gut brain axis, like that research is still very new, but I think probably most people have experienced that kind of nervous mind, nervous gut. So like, yeah, you know, that kind of goes to prove that connection does really exist,
yeah,
in a very real way. And the psychosomatic nervous system, I think, is so interesting, you know, with the training with Evelyn Triboli, talking about the interoceptive awareness and like where emotions are felt in the body. I thought that was kind of one of my most favorite parts of the training.
Yeah. I have a personal story I'll share too, is when I was just in my culinary program, I kind of was like in the more orthorexic realm, and I had just decided that maybe I had a gluten, you know, sensitivity, and I was going to explore that. And I went out to brunch with a group of friends and I ordered a chowder, and I had been like really, really good at like watching the gluten and, you know, all this stuff. And I had this chowder and I was having such a great time. And then I realized that it was a roux-based chowder, which means there's flour in it. And I didn't even think to ask. I was just having such a good time. I wasn't thinking about that. And I got sick to my stomach. But looking back on it, for me, I don't have any type of gluten intolerance. I don't actually have any food intolerances. And I know that now. But in that moment, I was so upset that I had missed the gluten in that chowder, that I had not thought to look into it further or ask the question, that I really do think, looking back, I made myself sick to my stomach.
You induced
that. I induced the, you know, like a self-fulfilling prophecy for me. And, you know, there are sensitivities to exist, and people do have celiac disease, obviously. Like, these are some real concerning issues. But for, I think, the general population, when it comes to orthorexia, when it comes to this pursuit of health in this really pure way, in the way, you know, quote unquote pure way that our culture is starting to move towards, you know, I do think that these kinds of relationships have been formed, and a lot of people are now scared of their relationships with food, and they're scared of food.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's so important to talk about, you know, how food is consumed, and not just the what, but the how. The how is huge. Like, how, you know, when food is consumed, in what kind of setting is it? Are people feeling relaxed, or are they rushed and on the go? You know, their stomachs will become upset if they're rushed and on the go, because it's not a kind of relaxed digestive state, right? Or, you know, are they feeling like drawn to that food? Is that food calling to them? Do they have a relationship and like a kind of central relationship with the food? You know, are they smelling it, tasting it, preparing it? Like, all those pieces, they're all so important to the health of, you know, our bodies and how we're functioning, and also how immune tolerant we are to foods in general.
Mm-hmm. And I think, just to link it back to FHA, these are extremely important conversations to have. A lot of women who are experiencing this may fall more on that orthorexic tendency scale, or have more perfectionistic tendencies. And so if, you know, they see something on the internet that says this specific food can cause hormonal imbalances, they may become very fearful and rigid around that. When, like, I love that word expansive Dr. Dunlap was talking about, when really releasing those food rules and releasing that fear is ultimately what will be most beneficial in supporting their hormones, getting their period back. And so it's extremely important, because these are, I don't want to make a blanket statement, but a typical profile of this sort of patient or client will be able to follow those strict food plans and kind of searching for that control mechanistic way of eating. And so it's just, it's a tricky topic when you're speaking about food, because it's FHA, you know, we're wanting to release that control and have more of that freedom, but there is a tendency to turn to food and try to control it even more tightly when you're trying to fix some health issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So then the next question is kind of more on hormone health and maybe not necessarily FHA, but I'm sure there is a component of this too. But a lot of people or a lot of women who are trying to conceive, or TTC as they say online, they say, okay, well now I'm going to start focusing on, you know, my diet and focusing on hormone health and focusing on all these things. And kind of that just kind of reminded me of like the hyper focus and the awareness. And what is something that these women should know if they are trying to get pregnant and they are immersed in diet culture?
Yeah. Restrictive eating patterns and fertility are a huge topic because I do a lot of fertility care. And when I see a lot of restrictive patterns and someone's coming in and maybe they're having trouble either getting their menses, they're not ovulating regularly, or they're, you know, they're having trouble getting pregnant, and there's a restrictive eating pattern, it absolutely has to be unpacked, because unless it is, there is a stress around food or around what is being consumed. Often there's an over focus on the what, like I said, rather than the how. So is, you know, our regular meals being consumed? You know, is often if the body doesn't feel nourished, the body will protect and conserve and not be as likely to ovulate. If there isn't enough if there isn't enough caloric intake for the body's perception of what it needs, then often the body will conserve and protect and not ovulate or bleed or have its menstrual flow. So it, you know, it's a huge, huge topic. And yeah, it just, there's not a, so, and a lot of people say, well, like, what's the perfect fertility diet? And I just, there's a lot of research on like what is most helpful in fertility in terms of what, but so little, and in my opinion, too little gets of emphasis is on the how, because it's really like, it's not just Mediterranean diet. Okay, that's, you know, that's the one that gets a lot of attention in fertility is the Mediterranean diet, but it's so much more about how, you know, it's so much more about, yes, there's amazing oils and there are amazing fats and amazing proteins and whole foods and all those things, but really how are these foods consumed is, and if women are stressed, they're just, it's so much harder to ovulate, so much harder to get pregnant.
So could you just briefly speak a little bit more on the stress factor?
Yeah. So when women's bodies are stressed, whether that's a perception that they're not safe in what they're eating. So if they perceive food as an enemy or as bad, any food type as bad, and they're feeling stressed because of food or stressed for any other reason, what happens, one of the links for stress and ovulation is that stress can intermittently raise a hormone known as prolactin. I was talking about that hormone earlier. And prolactin, when it goes up, it's the hormone that produces also milk in the mammary glands for breastfeeding, but it's also a hormone that can fluctuate with stress. And when that hormone goes up, it suppresses ovulation, which is in part why women who are breastfeeding are not ovulating regularly, or they're less likely to get pregnant. So that prolactin hormone relationship to stress can suppress ovulation, and women are not ovulating regular, or maybe not ovulating at all. So I do everything I can to minimize stress, help create safety around what is being consumed. Like often it's when women kind of just let go and say, you know what, I'm not going to try anymore, you know, and you hear that a lot, don't you? It's like, I'm going on vacation, or I stopped trying, or, oh my gosh, I kind of let go and I just let myself just be and eat and drink and whatever. And then I got pregnant, and they come into my office like freaking out because I got pregnant and they were on vacation. I'm like, that's great. You know, but yeah, it's creating like safety. Like my body is wise, and I just, you know, listening to the cues of the body is so key. The body has a natural ability to regulate, find homeostasis. You know, we have to listen and also realize that the culture is influencing how we feel safety or not safe with the food choices we're making. So it's really huge.
And I think also something that can be helpful is just that idea that your body is on your team. And I think for women in, you know, preconception or FHA, whatever it is, it can almost feel like they're at odds with their body in some way, or feel some sense of betrayal, but reframing it as your body is trying to protect you. And if it detects some sort of nutritional deficit, that's not a safe space to, you know, grow a baby. it will protect you in that way. So reframing can be a really powerful tool, I find, that, okay, how can you be on your body's side, acknowledge its wisdom, tune into its intuition, and realize that it knows what it's doing. And we just, I think a lot of times, try to micromanage it, but it's that exhale, it's that trust, and just tuning inward that can be really powerful.
I love that, Greta.
Yeah, I love that. I think that'll resonate for a lot of people. It's just kind of relinquishing a little bit of that control.
Yeah, feel safe with your food, like you said, Dr. Dunlap, feel safe around food and feel mm-hmm. safe in your body and trust yes. your body.
Yes.
Because it does, it knows what it's doing. It's trying to keep you alive every moment of every day.
It's so, so complex, you know, but also so wise. And we know so exactly. Really, really trusting that nature.
So just, you know, because this podcast is really geared more towards parents and caregivers, mm-hmm. people who are parents or people who are trying to become parents and kind of set themselves up for a good relationship with food and their body in general, if there are any parents or caregivers who have, you know, teens in their life, females that are going through menstruation, starting menstruation, how can those parents and caregivers support those younger adults, younger teens, to support their hormone health? You know, what should parents be on the lookout for if their teens noticing that they're missing periods, or, you know, they have concerns mm-hmm. about their stress and their any food restriction?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, this is such a big one. So when young women start menstruating, there is so much fear in our culture, right? I mean, I think that menstrual taboo is starting to be taken down a lot, you know, and by a lot of different circles, and try to dispel the menstrual taboo. But there's a lot of fear around that time and so many hormonal changes. And at the same time, it's like similar to perimenopause at the end of our life, at the early stage of our life, we are most often anovulatory, meaning we're not ovulating regularly early on. And that's normal, actually. That's like our body's trying to get into a cycle. It's learning about bleeding. It's not quite sinking, you know, and that takes years. But often what will happen is these bleeding patterns will be irregular. They might be heavy. They might be light. You know, they come at different times. That's actually really healthy, normal for young women. But what ends up happening is they get put on birth control really early because perhaps their periods are irregular, or, you know, there can be a lot of reasons why they might be put on birth control early. But just to normalize, not ovulating regularly when we start our periods is normal. That is what happens. So just getting to be with a doctor that you trust, that you feel like is speaking, bringing your daughter in to somebody you feel like is well-versed, having conversation, letting her have a conversation alone with the doctor, if she'd like to, or with you, you know, just some way that she feels comfortable to learn about her period and all the changes that are happening.
I think too, a really important piece to weave in is just about how bodies change. And that is such a gift. And it means, you know, you're living and engaging in this world. And so around puberty, we do see weight gain as the body gears up to start having a period. And that is a very high risk time for these young girls to develop disordered eating or body shame mm-hmm. or even eating disorders. So I think opening up that conversation too of your body's changing, and we see this at menopause too with that weight gain that's actually protective as we exit the cycling stage of our life. So opening up that conversation is that our bodies do change, you know, pregnancy, menopause, puberty, and those are high risk times in a culture that sees weight gain as negative in all different contexts, but recognizing, again, your body's on your team. It knows what it's doing, to trust it and to really just learn how to be at home in your body and nourish it and not be so just rigid and trying to control it.
And I have to say, I love what you ladies are doing with this podcast, because you're talking about how to start super young with your kiddos. You know, when I started listening to your podcast, I immediately turned to my husband. I said, you have to listen so that we can really have wise conversation around. We have two girls. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. And, you know, making sure that there isn't good or bad food choices, that it's really about, you know, just letting them self-regulate. And we've had that that strong kind of feeling in our household, but, you know, to really be careful around our language and any sort of cues that we, I mean, at a certain point, they're going to be learning on their own. They're going to hear conversations in so many environments that you can't control, but giving them the tools that at the beginning, so early on. And also what I do with my girls is I'm doing my best right now at this early stage to normalize periods. We talk about periods, we talk about bleeding, how girls bleed, you know, that's not scary, that it's not painful, that it's a gift. And, you know, I try to just kind of bring a lot of awareness around it now, even. So but all the different body, I love what Greta said. Yeah. All the different changes the bodies go through are a huge time of risk for disordered eating patterns to start. So having that conversation about how bodies change and how bodies are so beautiful, curvy and full and, you know, strong. And that's, the conversation.
Honoring that body diversity. Yes. And let the child or the teen know that their body is beautifully diverse in its own way.
Exactly.
And it doesn't conform to our standard of beauty, because our standard of beauty is so skewed, and our body's natural hormones and periods are proof of that, you know, and the consequence that we're seeing.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess that leads us to our next and maybe final question.
Yeah, our wrap up question. We want to be respectful of time, and we are very good at gabbing beyond the 45 minutes hour. So Jen, you want to?
I'll ask it. What is one thing that you wish everyone knew about hormones?
Oh, goodness. So hard to choose one, but I think if I were to boil it down, it's just the idea that, you know, women are not just baby-making machines. Their periods impact so many areas of our health outside of just reproductive function. So if we're hearing this message that, you know, oh, if you don't want to have kids, or if you're done having kids, a period serves no purpose, that really is not the case. Like I said, there's so much we don't yet understand, but we do know that having those natural regular cycles is protective for your bones, for your heart, for your brain health, and that your period is a way your body is communicating with you. And so how can we redefine menstruation as, you know, an avenue for deeper connection with our bodies and a way of understanding ourselves in a more full way, rather than something that is inconvenient or shameful, because it's really not. It's your body's way of communicating. And if you can see it in that light, it's really powerful, and see the value in it beyond just the reproductive system.
Yeah. And that actually makes me realize too that we should be mothers of boys.
Yeah.
You should start talking about your period with them too. Normalize it with the boys. And that's, I think, you know, a big part too, in removing the taboo and the kind of the shame around period.
Greta, you said it so perfectly, that there's just so much more to hormone balancing and to hormones and baby making. I really want women to come away with two kind of takeaway messages. The first is the body speaks. And it's so important to listen to the cues of the body. Your body is not misleading you. There's a reason behind why things are happening. So, you know, with anything in life, I try to look at it like there's an opportunity here. So what is the opportunity, and what can I learn from this experience? The next thing is, don't give up on trying to find somebody who's your advocate and who can help you really be fully, feel like you're fully informed and empowered by the choice that you are making about what comes next for you in your healthcare. It's not about what your doctor wants you to do. It's about you feeling like you have good information and tools that you can make a good choice. And that choice might be birth control, you know, it might be, you know, that you're on a oral birth control pill. It's totally your choice. And it's a good choice if it's your choice. So that it's really important that you mostly just have all options out on the table in terms of what is possible, and that you know that there are options out there for you. So to just not stop digging until you feel like you've been given all the information you feel satisfied with.
I love that. Thank you. And then before we totally sign off, what could you guys share a few resources for our audience members to get more information teach about you or about FHA or hormone health. And we'll share these in our show notes as well.
Absolutely. So I am a huge bookworm. It was really hard to think about, okay, what are, you know, the top few suggestions? So number one, if we're talking about FHA, No Period Now What by Nicola Rinaldi is by far the most comprehensive resource I've found. So it's a book. She also has a Facebook support group for women who are working to recover their periods. So that is always my top recommendation when we're talking about amenorrhea. Another few books just that are helpful for the process of healing food and body relationships. In Body by Connie Subcheck. She's one of the founders of The Body Positive in Berkeley, California. Really amazing book, and it weaves in those intuitive eating and health at every size principles. And then also one that I really enjoy is called For Keeps by Victoria Zachheim. And it's a collection of essays by women just talking about how their bodies change and talking about their relationships with themselves and movement. And it's a really beautiful way to just feel connected and seen in a way that's, you know, you don't see when you open a magazine or just scroll through social media usually. And then Fertility Friday podcast is a great one for women who are wanting to learn more about hormonal health and fertility. And there's so many, I could go on for days, but I guess the final thing on that is just notice what your environment is. I think social media specifically is a really powerful tool. So there are so many amazing people you can follow who, you know, how is your perception of health and beauty and fitness and food being influenced by the photos you're seeing as you scroll through? So, you know, unfollowing people who aren't helping you build that deeper connection with yourself and finding diverse representations. And there's so many amazing people on Instagram doing great things. So using that as a tool for your benefit is really beneficial.
And I 100% agree. And we should say your research, Greta, is going to be out there in publication at some point. I know we're still in the works of figuring out the results and analyzing, but it's, do you want to just mention your research?
Yeah, quickly? Absolutely. So for part of my kind of capstone project for my master's, Dr. Dunlap and I have been working on a study. So FHA is a really big area of interest for me. And I am also, like we've talked about, of course, really interested in intuitive eating and seeing that as a potentially really powerful tool for prevention and intervention and treatment. So we finished data collection, still need to finalize the analysis and write everything up. But essentially, we recruited women who have FHA and gave them the intuitive eating assessment. So that was validated by Tracy Tilka. She's at Ohio State. So just going to compare that against the numbers she found when she gave that survey to, it was female college students. So a little bit different population, but still analogous. And I've done some preliminary analysis and just seeing that their scores are a bit lower in our population, which is really interesting. So I'm excited to dive deeper into that and see, you know, the significance and all of that. We got to dive into statistics deeper, but I think that intuitive eating and FHA really can be powerful when paired together. And there's not a lot of that in research right now.
There's so nothing. There's nothing.
Right.
So we're really excited. We're really mm-hmm. excited to get this out there into the literature for doctors, because doctors are going to be looking at that literature, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah. Stay tuned. We'll let you know. Mm-hmm. That's in the works.
Yeah. We'd love to maybe have you guys back on when you have those results and you're ready to really dive in and talk about them, because I do think that this is a great avenue to just kind of share that information and elaborate. It could be, you know, part two to this conversation.
Sounds great. Oh,
absolutely. We'd love that.
Yeah. And the only resource that I'll add, because we got to give such good, great resources, but is that your doctor can be your advocate and can be and on your team. So, but you also might find that you need a kind of like a healthcare community, really cultivating that. And it might look like, you know, a really positive sister or mother or friend, you know, not necessarily somebody who's medically trained, but who just helps encourage you to feel safe around your choices and to listen to your body. And also, you know, your doctor is there. Many doctors are very caring and wanting to help, and they, you know, want to help you learn about this area. So they're and looking for people who are trained in this and who you feel like can really speak to what you need.
And of course, we're very lucky to have you, Dr. Dunlap, here in Maine with us. So, so rest assured, we will, you know, put your website and information as well. So if there are local Maine listeners that want to chat hormones and all things, then they can find you there.
Yeah, and I can be I can support women locally and internationally. So I'm really can be. You can reach out and we can discuss the options.
Very cool.
That's amazing. And last but not least, Greta, can people come see you for individual sessions, or how can our audience find you in the other Portland?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm here in Portland, Oregon, across the country. And my website is www.nutritionforgood.net. And so I do see clients over the phone or on Skype. So I would love to hear from anyone who is interested in chatting and see how I can best support you.
That's amazing. Well, ladies, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. And we're so excited to have you hopefully back on in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. That was such an honor to be invited onto your show.
You've been listening to the Food Confidence Podcast. I'm Jennifer Bravo.
And I'm Andrea Paul.
If you have any questions about the things you heard in today's episode or have topics you'd like us to discuss in the future, send us an email at foodconfidencepod@gmail.com or follow us and message us on Instagram at foodconfidencepod.